Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
There are scores of books about the life of champion fighter Muhammad Ali, but even in all the volumes written about Ali, author Jonathan Eig felt like something was missing. I had grown up watching Ali box and even had a poster of the fighter hanging in his room when he's a kid. I, like many other Americans, knew of Ali's activism and his conversion to Islam, but he wanted to know more about what motivated the fighter to protest the Vietnam War and convert. The result of his research can be found in his new biography, Ali, A Life. Jonathan Eig and I sat down to speak about his work, and I started by asking him to give more context to the popularity of boxing when Ali first entered the ring.
Well, heavyweight boxing championship matches back then in the 60s were bigger than 100 Super Bowls. They were enormous cultural events, and the heavyweight champion of the world was almost a mythic figure. He was godlike. He was seen as somebody who represented the best of all American virtues, values. He was big and strong and brave, and he took on the other biggest, strongest, bravest men in the world, not just Americans, but from all over. And it was really the only position where you would be called champ for the rest of your life. It was huge.
And it was Sonny Liston at that point, right, when Ali took over?
That's right. Sonny Liston was the champion of the early 60s, and he kind of did not carry all those values. He was seen as a thug. He was an ogre. He was a criminal, and his autobiography was called The Champion No One Wanted, and that's very much how it felt.
Who was the champ when Ali was young? Was there someone that he had idolized as a kid?
Well, he grew up loving Joe Louis and loving a smaller fighter, Sugar Ray Robinson, because Robinson was just so fast and so beautiful to watch. So Ali was a heavyweight, and Sugar Ray was not, but Ali nevertheless really idolized Sugar Ray.
What did he like about him, his fighting style or his personal style?
It was both. You know, he fought beautifully. He was fast and powerful. Heavyweights were famous for being just these giant men who knocked out their opponents. But for Sugar Ray Robinson, boxing was more artistic. And it carried outside the ring as well because he dressed elegantly. He had an entourage before the word was commonly used in that way. And he drove a fleet of beautiful Cadillacs in all different shades of the rainbow. So I think Ali really saw a lot that he liked in Sugar Ray Robinson.
And this is public radio that we're doing this interview for. So we have to establish that boxing is a sport worthy of discussion. And I want to read this paragraph about boxing that you write. You write, to enter a boxing ring is to willingly lose control. You train, you study, you commit yourself fully. Perhaps you make up your mind on a strategy, a plan of attack. Perhaps you pray. And then you step through the ropes and face an opponent who is also trained, studied, committed himself fully, possibly prayed, and who has adopted a strategy meant to render yours null and void. The fight starts and all is irresolution. Anything can happen. Victory, defeat, even death. The great fighters lose themselves in the void. They don't think about it. They ride the rush. For someone who doesn't like boxing, there's so many people who've turned against it. Before we start talking in depth about Ali's life, what is it that draws you to boxing?
I find it impossible to look away. I don't want to like it. It's far too brutal. My children at first didn't even believe there was such a thing. How could we sanction two men in a ring trying to hurt each other, trying to knock each other out? But there's something very primal about it that, you know, watching two people go at it to see who's the stronger, I think just somehow connects to just something deep in our DNA.
Now, Ali grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, so in the South, in the Jim Crow South. And when he's asked about his life later, his childhood, he always said, oh, it was a happy childhood. What was it like?
Well, it was relatively happy. He was a gregarious kid. He was the leader of the gang in his neighborhood, not a criminal gang, just the leader of the pack, I should say. He had a fairly comfortable upbringing. His mother and father both worked. They made okay money. They did not grow up in poverty like so many boxing champions. And Ali was a cut-up. He was a class clown, and he seemed to always be enjoying himself. Now, that's not to say it was perfect. He grew up in the segregated South in Louisville at a time when black people were not treated anywhere near equally. His father was a heavy drinker and was prone to violence in the home against his children and against his wife. So Ali grew up with some difficulties, but he still nevertheless never talked about his childhood in anything but glowing terms.
There's an almost mythical story of how he discovered boxing. He'd gotten a beautiful bike that he was supposed to share with his brother. He and his brother are really, really close. And they'd gotten a really expensive bike, about, what was it, like $60 or something?
That's right.
And it got stolen. And they were on the hunt for it. And they stumbled across a boxing gym instead.
That's right. They were looking for a police officer to report the stolen bicycle. And they found a police officer who was working in a boxing gym training kids, and it changed Ali's life. He was really thunderstruck, just the sight of the gym, the smell of it, everything. But I think what really struck him was that here was a white police officer who was being kind and helpful, who wanted to teach him how to box, and here was a place where black and white kids mixed. They even punched one another, something that you couldn't really do outside the boxing ring, certainly not in the Jim Crow South.
From the beginning, was he seen as someone who could be a heavyweight champion, or was he just one in a group and didn't really stand out?
He stood out for a couple of reasons. First of all, he worked harder than anybody in that gym. He was just obsessed with training and with his fitness and began exercising really diligently. But also, he was talented. He wasn't seen as an obvious superstar because he never had really great boxing technique. But he was so quick that he didn't really need it. He was able to avoid punches, so he never learned proper boxing form. But he grew big and strong, and he was incredibly fast. And he had a great success. He won a lot of amateur tournaments right off the bat, and marched pretty quickly and directly to a shot at the Olympic gold medal in 1960.
Terence Wallasek, but the most popular USA winner was the lighthearted Cassius Marcellus Clay V in white here, who easily defeated Poland's Zbigniew Patrykowski. Clay was by far the best of the USA boxers. His Roman
name. How did he do that? How do you climb the ranks of boxing as an amateur? What is the process, and how do you get fights, and how do you earn the berth to go to the Olympics?
While he was in high school, Ali, or Cassius Clay, as he was known at the time, Cassius Clay began fighting in first local tournaments and then regional tournaments and then national tournaments. The Golden Glove boxing tournaments were huge cultural events in the 50s, and thousands of people would come and sit in big arenas. And the fights would be televised, sometimes nationally. So even when he was still in high school, some of Ali's fights were televised nationally. And if you keep winning, you get a shot at bigger and bigger tournaments. You then get a shot at the Olympics, and that's what happened to Ali. And he not only made it to the Olympics in 1960, but to many people's surprise, he won the gold medal as a light heavyweight.
And you can actually watch some of these televised. I mean, there's him against Madigan, who was Australian, right?
That's right, Tony Madigan.
And it played on like ABC on a weeknight. There was boxing every night on TV.
Yeah, boxing, the ratings for boxing were higher than the ratings for I Love Lucy at the time. And it was an enormous thing that, you know, could propel a high school student to fame even before he had won the gold medal. Ali's name was known around the country, and he loved it. Oh, my God. He would walk around, just stopping people on the street saying, "Do you know who I am?" He couldn't get enough of the attention.
I can't imagine a teenager, a 17-year-old, and it being broadcast nationally and then going back to his high school. But he did graduate. He still got a degree.
Barely. He was at the bottom of his class, and the principal even made a speech to the staff saying, "I know some of you think this kid shouldn't get a diploma, but he may be famous someday, and we want to be known as the high school that the champ came from, not the high school that flunked the champ."
So he went off to Rome. It was Rome, right?
That's right.
Yeah, Rome, and won the gold medal. And at this point, is he beloved?
Yeah, he was beloved. I mean, some sports writers were a little concerned that he seemed to have a lot of attitude, that he was lippy, the word they used. They called him the Louisville Lip. And he would trash talk his opponents. And you weren't supposed to do that back then. You know, this was when sportsmanship still mattered.
Cassius, you've been going around saying that you're the resurrector of the fight game, the savior of boxing.
Everything.
What do you think that boxing would be today if it wasn't, if you weren't around?
Oh, man, if it wasn't for me, they'd be doing good to get $50 a ringside seat. I'd have raised the price up to $250.
And black kids especially were expected to be respectful of the establishment and of their white opponents. And young Cassius Clay had a lot of nerve, and that upset some people. But nevertheless, for the most part, he was seen as a bright spot on the Olympic team. He was the one everybody wanted to meet. Everybody wanted to have their picture taken with him. And when the Olympics were over, people like Jesse Owens and others who'd been around a while were predicting that this kid had star potential. It wasn't clear yet whether he had the potential to be a great fighter, but his personality was certainly an exciting one.
You write about his fighting style and why sports writers were a little contemptuous of it. A ballerina was supposed to be lithe and light on her feet. A blues singer was supposed to wail with sorrow in his voice. And a heavyweight boxer was supposed to act more like King Kong than Fred Astaire. The sports writers who always need something to complain about. And boxing writing, there's something about it where they really love to wax on about with flowery language about human great human endeavors. They were not taken with Ali's style. What was his style like? What was different about his boxing compared to others?
People felt like he didn't hit hard enough. That was the main thing. He danced around and he dodged punches. And when you're a heavyweight, you're supposed to just be manly and take it and throw the biggest punches and take the biggest punches. And Ali said, well, why should I have to do that? Why can't I just duck? You know, this is silly. And, you know, his most famous phrase that was adhered to him, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, that was actually coined by A.J. Liebling, and it was meant as an insult. Heavyweights weren't supposed to float or sting like bees. They were supposed to hit like a Mack truck.
Was this something that he came up with all himself, his style, or was there a trainer who helped him, who encouraged the style?
No, it was all Ali. His trainers tried to teach him to abandon some of these bad habits he had. They wanted him to keep his hands up to protect his head. They wanted him to duck instead of just pulling his head back at the last minute. They wanted him to set his feet before he punched. But Ali had his own way of doing things, and it worked for him very well, especially in the beginning of his career. I think in the second half of his career, he paid the price for those flaws in his technique, and he began taking a lot of punishment, in part because he never learned how to really properly box.
What kind of punishment do you mean? Are you talking about permanent damage or just like
pain? No, he took a lot of punches in the second half of his career, and he didn't, because he didn't keep his hands up, because he didn't bob and weave, and that not only caused him to lose a few fights, it caused him, I believe, permanent brain damage, and he ended up absorbing far more punches than he should have, and fighting far too long, because he believed that it was okay to take all those punches, and he would absorb them and just wait until his opponent's tired before launching his own attacks, and it was not only unorthodox, it was unhealthy.
So even if you're an Olympic champion, you've got the gold medal, you come back, you're young, you're powerful, it doesn't mean you just get to choose fights. There isn't a system like there is with baseball or football where, you know, here's this team playing here and then you naturally come to the finals. You've got to seduce other opponents. You've got to box against this person and that person, sometimes against people that are way too below you just to keep boxing. And he wants to fight the champ, but he's not allowed to fight the champ. The champ doesn't want to fight him. How did he end up fighting against the heavyweight champion, Sonny Liston?
Well, there's a hierarchy. You have to prove that you're worthy of a shot at the championship. And you also have to, you know, develop your skills. So his trainers were trying to get him fights that would help him learn to be a better boxer while proving that he was worthy of a shot at Sonny Liston. And it took almost 4 years. 1964, he finally got his shot against Sonny Liston. And partly it was because he earned his way there, but also because he was such a personality, and he called so much attention to himself. He modeled himself a little bit after Gorgeous George, the wrestler, who made himself hated on purpose because he knew that it would help him sell tickets. And everybody knew that that Sonny Liston against Cassius Clay would sell a lot of tickets because they were both such despised figures that it would just be a great the press would have a blast with it, and people would pay to see it. So he got his shot at Sonny Liston perhaps before he was really ready as a fighter, or before people thought he was ready, I should say, but in part because he was such a great drawing card.
Louisville, Kentucky, wearing white trunks with red stripes, weighing 210 and one-half pounds, the former Olympic light heavyweight champion, Cassius Clay. Clay.
And at this point, he had some freedom as a boxer and some lack of stress because he had this consortium of men from Louisville who had gotten together and kind of owned him, but it wasn't that bad of a deal for him. How do boxers make money, and how was his contract with these guys a little different?
Young Cassius Clay, coming out of the Olympics, may have been the best cared for boxer in the history of the sport. Usually boxers end up with managers who are a shady bunch.
Yeah, we think about Don King, you know,
right?
Who shows up later.
Right, and the mafia was deeply involved in the boxing world at this time. So very often, you're dealing with people who have ties to organized crime. But Ali was protected by this group of Louisville businessmen who also owned racehorses, and they saw this as an investment. They saw it as a way to support a local kid and help the community, and also as a way to take care of him, to protect him from those ugly parts of the boxing world. And they put him on a salary. They paid all his expenses. They hired his managers and trainers for him. They took a lot of the, and they also set up a trust fund so that he would have money when he retired. For the most part, I mean, there's something condescending about a group of wealthy white people feeling like they have to take care of this black kid. But they did a great job. Ali was very well managed and had his money taken care of, and he was really grateful to them for the rest of his life. He expressed his thanks.
So he grew up in Jim Crow South, but he also had been trained by a white trainer to begin with in that boxing gym, the police officer who took him under his wing. Then he's got this consortium of businessmen who have been helping him along and mentoring him on the business side and taking care of him. So he wasn't really a natural. There are parts of it where you think like, oh, he'd be a natural person to look to the Nation of Islam because of growing up in the Jim Crow South. But he wasn't that political at this time, even though so many of other people, his peers around the country who are young African-Americans, were becoming politically active. He still hadn't really been political up until this moment. Why not?
It's interesting. He was just obsessed with boxing. He openly disdained protests. You know, the Louisville school district was desegregating while Ali was in junior high and high school. And there were protests all the time about the process of that desegregation. And Cassius Clay said he wanted no part of it, that he was a boxer. He wasn't interested in politics or social movements. And he said he went to a protest once and somebody threw hot water on him and he was never going to go back. That was enough more trouble than he could stand. So it is interesting. But he also grew up in a home where his father was very angry about racism, talked all the time about Marcus Garvey and that the only way black people were ever going to get treated equally was to leave the United States entirely, that America was never going to give black people a fair chance. And he grew up, he was about the same age as Emmett Till, and as you know, every black kid in America knew what had happened to Emmett Till. So Ali was not interested in seemingly uninterested in activism, but he was highly attuned to racial issues, and as I think you had to be growing up when he did.
And then it was a pop song or a song. It's not really a pop song, I guess. It's a calypso song that kind of awakened him to his political side. It's called A White Man's Heaven is a Black Man's Hell. And this is sung by Louis Farrakhan. who had been a calypso singer, known as the Charmer, right? Was that his name?
That's right.
The Charmer. And he has there's a song of his I know called Never Make an Ugly Woman Your Wife, I think, was the advice in the song. Anyway, but this was much different from Farrakhan's early calypso songs, were all about love and romance and battling other calypso singers. This was about how African Americans were brought over and enslaved and forced to take on the white man's religion. And it really spoke to Ali. Where did he discover the song? Where did he first hear it?
He probably first heard it in Chicago. He traveled to Chicago several times for boxing tournaments. And this song was really popular. You would hear it in black cafes and black restaurants. You could buy the single in a record store. And it had a great beat, and it had these lyrics that really intrigued Ali, because they made him think, you know, why was he a Christian? Why did he have this name, Cassius Clay? These weren't names or religions that came from his people in Africa. These were names that were stuck to him by his grandparents, great-grandparents' owners. The owners of the slaves chose these things. So as the song suggested, if all of this was done by and for the benefit of the white man, why did the black man keep accepting it? And that really made him think differently about it. And he became intrigued. He began wanting to hear more, learn more about the Nation of Islam and its leader, Elijah Muhammad. And even while he was in high school, he became intrigued. And as his boxing career began, he began seeking out more information. He began attending Muslim rallies. And he got to know Malcolm X because he was such a prominent boxer. He was traveling a lot now, and occasionally he would cross paths with Malcolm, and they became friends. And Malcolm really decided he was going to be a mentor to this kid and teach him more about the religion.
And when did it become about the religion and not just the politics and being awakened politically as a young man, and really become an important part of his identity and where he's willing to change his name to Muhammad Ali?
There's no way to really separate the religion from the cultural issues. From the beginning, he's drawn to this because of what it says about being a black man in America. And the religion is a way of telling that story. It's a way of creating a philosophy and an organization, you know, an identifying theory. But Ali is never really drawn to the religion strictly in spiritual terms. It's always very practical. It's always very earthly. It's always about where the black man stands in America today and how it can be different. And this religion offers some guiding principles for that.
So when he becomes the heavyweight champion, he's still Cassius Clay. Did people know about his ties to the Nation of Islam, if it was just ties at that point, and he hadn't declared that he was a part of the Nation of Islam or a follower of Elijah Muhammad? And how did people react to it, and what did people think about it?
In the build-up to that heavyweight championship fight in 1964, there were rumors that Ali might have been joining the Nation of Islam, that he'd been seen with Malcolm X, and that he'd been seen attending rallies, lectures by Elijah Muhammad. And there was a lot of concern about it. There was a lot of anger. And Ali was being noncommittal. He was denying it for a long time because he knew that it would affect his career, that it would be damaging for his reputation, that some people might not want to pay to see him fight. So he waited until after his fight with Sonny Liston. And when he beat Liston, and if you watch the fight right after the fight, he's in the ring yelling that he speaks to God, that he knew he was going to win, that he's the greatest, and he the next day he gives a press conference, and in that press conference announces that he is indeed a member of the Nation of Islam, that he believes in the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, that he doesn't have to do what white people tell him to do anymore. He doesn't have to say what they want him to say. He doesn't have to follow the religion that they want him to follow, that he's free. And it's really a powerful, powerful moment. And in many ways, it's his declaration of independence. It's the moment in which he speaks up and says, black athletes don't have to be subservient anymore. We don't have to do what you tell us to do.
He had spent the night before with Malcolm X right after he won, right?
That's right. He and Malcolm X, Sam Cooke and Jim Brown were in a hotel room that night after the fight. And I think Malcolm helped convince Ali that it was time to step out on his own and to speak up for what he believed in.
Don't you wish you could have been there that night?
Oh, my God.
With those four men?
I can only imagine.
And so at this point, I just can't get my head around the fact, because I grew up with Ali being the champ, beloved, a human being that everyone, we could all agree on. It was the Fonz and Muhammad Ali that we could, everyone in the United States could agree on those two people. And at this point, he's the champ. He comes out and says he's a follower of the Nation of Islam. And he is, and this is even before he speaks out against the Vietnam War. People, African Americans, everybody, does everybody just dislike Muhammad Ali at this point?
Yeah, he's pretty well hated. Even Martin Luther King announces that Muhammad Ali should keep his mouth shut and stick to boxing. He doesn't know what he's talking about because he's declaring the civil rights movement a waste of time. So even the NAACP and Martin Luther King, others who are in the mainstream of the civil rights movement, think that he's a fool. White Americans think that he's being obnoxious, that he's being disrespectful, that he is failing to appreciate the wealth and fame that America has given him by letting him box, as if he needed permission from white America to box. And it only gets worse when he changes his name to Muhammad Ali. What kind of gobbledygook is that? And gets worse again when he says that his religion forbids him from fighting in Vietnam. Then he's a traitor on top of everything else. And I think you can make the case that he's the most unpopular man in America at this point by, 66, 67, and certainly the most unpopular man among white Americans.
How sincere was his draft dodging at the beginning? Because when you talk, when you quote him from the beginning of when he says, "I do not want to participate in the Vietnam War," a lot of his talk was about, doesn't the United States realize how much tax money they're giving up by, based on my earnings, I can be earning millions and they'd make millions. And it seems to be more of his, big blowhard, I'm the greatest kind of stuff. And then it really does seem to turn sincere as he thinks about it more. But at that beginning, do you think that he really was sincere?
I think he was sincere in that he didn't want to go. And the reasons changed. And that's perhaps, human. I think most people evolve in their beliefs. But, yeah, at first he said, "I just don't want to go. You could take my tax dollars and you could buy bomber jets with that stuff, with that money." Then he said, "Well, it's racist that black people are being drafted disproportionately to white people and they're dying over there in disproportionate numbers and can't even be treated equally here in this country. Why should I fight for a country that treats me second class?"
"The real enemies of my people are right here, not in Vietnam."
And then it becomes a religious argument after he consults with Elijah Muhammad, and that's the argument that he ends up going. He's convicted of draft evasion, and it's that argument about his religious beliefs that he ends up taking to the Supreme Court and ultimately having his case, his conviction reversed.
You say that Ali's views could be slippery, even incongruous at times, which that's what it felt like, his whole discussion of the draft dodging and how it kept moving around. But then there'd be truths to it that people would grab onto, that other people, when he'd point out, that African Americans make up 10% of the population, but 20% of the deaths in Vietnam. I mean, he didn't look up those statistics himself, but he helped amplify them. How many other people... Did he ignite political fires in other people, or was he just a guy speaking out by himself?
I think it's clear that Ali had huge influence in the anti-war movement. He was really one of the first celebrities, one of the first famous Americans to come out against the Vietnam War. And when he was convicted of draft evasion, at that point the war was still relatively popular. But as more Americans were getting called up to serve, as the movement against the war began to spread across college campuses, Ali was banned from boxing. He was touring the United States, giving lectures on college campuses. I think he became a real role model, not just because he was opposed to the war, but because he was willing to sacrifice for his beliefs. He gave up his heavyweight championship. He gave up his career. He was prepared to go to jail, lost millions of dollars. And that kind of sincerity, whether you agreed with him or not, you had to respect.
And was that what finally changed how people felt about him after a few years of seeing that he really was that committed? And then when he makes his comeback and beats George Foreman as the champ again and reclaims his heavyweight title after being stripped of it, is it that America finally caught up with him, or had he changed and become more palatable somehow?
It's both. He's seen as a martyr, and we have to respect the fact that he took this punishment and he came back and fought his way back. He gave up the best years of his career, and then he comes back and he gets knocked down in his first fight. He loses his first – well, it's a second fight back against Joe Frazier. And we see him – we see the toughness. We see that he's willing to sacrifice and earn the heavyweight championship again, even though it takes him years to claim that title again.
Muhammad Ali has done it! The great man has done it!
At the same time, Ali's not talking politics. He's not talking race. You know, we're into the 1970s. We're into the age of the Jeffersons. You cited the Happy Days a little earlier. Mm-hmm. But once we get into the age of the Jeffersons, the whole discussion around race in America is different. You know, we don't see the rioting in the streets quite as much. We see the movement shifting into the courts. We see greater assimilation. We see black elected officials in greater numbers. And Ali drops the subject almost entirely from the 70s, except for to make jokes with Howard Cosell. So he's a much less threatening figure, and that's when you start to see the public embracing him. That's when you see kids like me in the 1970s hanging his poster on the wall and not even aware very much, only maybe dimly, that he had been this anti-war crusader.
I remember when I found that out later in my life, I was shocked. I had no idea. He had just always been the champ to me, and that was about it. He kept fighting and fighting and fighting way too long. Was that his own drive or was that his entourage? And by this point, Don King, the unstoppable Don King, had gotten involved in it too.
I have to put the blame on Ali. He needed the money. He liked the money. He liked the scene. He liked the entourage. And, after he beat George Foreman and Elijah Muhammad said to him, it's time to stop. And he'd always obeyed Elijah Muhammad in everything. He divorced his first wife because Elijah Muhammad told him to. And yet he could not stop boxing, even when Elijah Muhammad ordered him to. He said, they want to pay me $3 million to fight bums like Joe Bugner. How do you pass up that kind of easy money? And, he wasn't thinking of the long-term consequences, the fact that, even though he could beat Joe Bugner, every time he fought, he was doing more damage to his brain cells. It was just too easy to take that money, and it was hard to walk away and imagine another kind of a lifestyle.
What do you think about boxing now? Do you watch boxing?
No, not anymore. I haven't really watched it since, the days of maybe Lennox Lewis, Riddick Bowe. It's been a while, and I find it still, difficult to turn away when I see a match on TV. But in general, I can't really justify it. It's just too brutal to see somebody like Ali, this gorgeous man, this beautiful personality, this quick wit, to see him reduced to somebody who can barely speak for the last several decades of his life is just, it's just too much to take.
Why did you decide to write this book? There have been other books written about Ali before. And what did you want to, when you started out? It's a monumental undertaking. Why did you do it?
I wanted to treat him like the historical figure that he is. I wanted to get beyond the sports pages and really write a big book that would look at his life, his place in America, why he is, and I think always will be, the most important athlete in American history. Somebody who really changed our country, changed our culture. And it had been 50 years since he rose to the championship, and it was enough time to go back and put some of that in perspective, to look at what he meant to us in terms of race, in terms of religion, the war movement. And it's just such a big life, and I wanted to give it the big biography that it deserved.
Is he the greatest? You say he's the most important sports figure. Is he the greatest boxer of all time?
Not technically, perhaps. I think there were other boxers who were technically greater fighters. But in terms of personality, in terms of his impact on the sport, and is certainly in terms of his impact on the culture, to me, he's the greatest.
America, the original owner of this nation, is cooped up on a reservation. So, my friend, it's easy to tell. White man heaven, black man hell.
That is Louis Farrakhan singing the song that made Cassius Clay decide to explore the Nation of Islam. White man's heaven is a black man's hell. We've been listening to Jonathan Eig. He wrote the book Ali, A Life. It is one of the Thread's top nonfiction books of the year. If you go to nprnews.org/thread, you can see them. We also have Ranger Games and From Here to Eternity and a really wonderful memoir called My Soul Looks Back by Jessica P. Harris, who's a cookbook writer and historian, and she writes about being in the 1970s in New York intelligentsia circles, and it's a fantastic book. So go to nprnews.org/thread.
White man heaven is a black man hell.